You're listening to a Share Radio podcast.
Share Radio Weekend, getting to the beating heart of business.
Welcome to the shop floor. I'm Nick Peters. This week, the gig economy in 18th century Britain. Lord Baker slams the government's education policy as inadequate to the needs of industry. And what does the fourth industrial revolution mean for business? We start, though, with a quite surprising statistic from the CIPD, which is the professional body for HR. They've discovered that just 5% of new fathers and 8% of new mothers have opted for shared parental leave since its introduction in April 2015. I asked Gerwin Davis, who's labour market analyst at the CIPD, for his reaction.
Well, overall, we think it's perhaps unsurprising, but still very disappointing, given the implications this has, not least for equal pay. We see the equal pay gap accelerate during the sort of 30 to 40 age bracket, and the clear reason for that is that women tend to have children, and of course the legislation was designed to give dads a greater opportunity to take up the right and play a greater role in the upbringing of their children. But ultimately it's a financial decision that counts the vast majority of dads off. And if you look at the statistics, they show that very few dads do it, and that's partly because very few employers actually offer any form of enhanced statutory pay package, which ultimately is just around £120 a week for the first 2 weeks. So it's no surprise, really.
So remind us how it's supposed to work. The employer is supposed to make this available, but it seems to me that very few of them actually are notifying staff that SPL is available.
There seems to be a wider communication issue with it. But of course, it's among a raft of different policy interventions from government. So it's very difficult to keep pace with the whole range of different policies. Again, that's perhaps unsurprising. We do think that greater attention should be given to this. But we also know that communication is just a part of the problem. There is a recognition among the majority that the right is available to them. But ultimately, for dads, the option is to either take the last 3 months of the 12-month paternity leave arrangement, which would be completely unpaid, which is unrealistic for many, many parents, or they take up months 6 to 9, where you'd get the statutory minimum of just under £140. And of course, many mums are perhaps reluctant to give up that sort of 6 to 9 months, because that's, for various reasons, a significant period for them. And as a result, we're still not seeing a large uptake in shared parental leave.
It was hailed as something of a milestone in the advance of gender equality when it was introduced in April last year. But is there any evidence, and I'm wondering perhaps if these stats you've come out with now suggest there isn't, that it was actually responding to a demand?
There's a very interesting question, and I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that. What we do know is that there is definitely a greater demand for among dads to play a greater role in their children's upbringing. You see that anecdotally in terms of the dads playing a greater role in looking after the children out of hours in a way that perhaps didn't happen 20, 30 years ago. So undoubtedly there's a demand from that point of view. I think the barrier is the financial one and the practical one. And unfortunately, the balance is shifting too heavily in favour of the mum financially, unless, of course, the mum is the bigger earner, in which case it obviously makes a lot more sense for the mum to return to work. But again, if you look at the statutory pay package, it's still weighted towards women in relation to men. So there's almost a financial incentive for mums to stay at home. And equally, as I say, I think there are statistics show that only Well, as many as 3/4 of employers just offer the statutory minimum of £120 a week, and that's just for the first 2 weeks of the baby's life in relation to paternity pay. And of course, what that does is encourages perhaps dads to return not just after the 2 week legislative period, but actually perhaps in many cases before, because they simply can't afford to live on £240 a week. For obvious financial constraint reasons.
In that case, isn't it somewhat unrealistic to expect employers to pick up the slack in a meaningful way? Because, you know, times are not exactly prosperous at the moment.
They're not, but we have a very high employment rate at the moment. We have a situation where we've come out of the European Union, where we face the distinct probability or inevitability in some people's eyes of restrictions on migration. So employers will have to review their recruitment channels in the next couple of years, because they will have to find staff in a way that they haven't found them before. Now, one of the obvious routes for that is women returners. And we know there's a huge issue in terms of the participation rate of women returning to work. Of course, we're focusing very heavily on shared parental leave. What we should also focus on is the lack of childcare provision here as well. There's some support for 3 to 4 year olds, but very little for 0 to 2 year olds, when obviously that is equally critical, if not more critical period for parents. And overall, employers are missing out on, you know, the very highly skilled, talented individuals that could actually play a greater long-term role in their organization. Too many mums are simply having and being forced to leave their organizations because of the lack of childcare and lack of wider support. And that's ultimately missing out on, you know, 50% of, well, not quite 50%, but a vast proportion of the population.
Part of your research demonstrates that an awful lot of this stuff, and I think you touched on it a little earlier, is very complicated, and employers are frankly not up to speed as they should be. But if, you know, one can understand when there are so many rules and regulations around. I mean, you just mentioned the tax-free childcare. Only 31%. Are aware that it's going to be introduced in early 2017. Are you surprised by the lack of knowledge, or is it just because there's so much stuff for employers to get their heads around?
I think it's a combination of both, but surprisingly, this has been one of the most interventionist governments, certainly in my working lifetime. When you look back at the last 3 to 4 years, you've seen the introduction of the National Living Wage, you've seen the rolling out of the auto-enrolment pension scheme, which is forcing employers to provide a pension. You have the apprenticeship levy that's coming in April 2017. And that's, you know, that's ignoring the changes to employment law and changes to immigration policy. So one could be forgiven for, employers rather, could be forgiven for perhaps not pushing all of these issues, because of course a lot of them are mandatory. So, and if you look at the National Living Wage, for instance, that just has huge implications for the resourcing and salary strategy and the salary bill for organisations just in itself, and having to update that every year, not just for one age group, but for several age groups, because of course they're different rates. So one, you know, we should offer some sort of slack for some employers, but the penny really needs to drop that employers, if they are going to complain about recruitment difficulties, also need to look in-house to their own retention strategies. And the real quick win here for employers is to look at the childcare package and the wider package they offer to parents of younger children, because too many are leaving the labour market and often coming back into the labour market 3 to 4 years' time on a lower skilled role and in part-time employment. And we've done a lot of work on this, which shows a progression for part-time workers. It essentially is the death knell for future progression opportunities. And what we need to do is find a way, and flexible working is obviously key to this, finding a way of keeping people in the jobs market, whether that be on a job sharing arrangement or part-time, with a view then to becoming full-time when the opportunity arises again. And that requires flexible working, but it also requires parity, greater parity between the parents, which currently is not happening.
Is there any suggestion that there is a bias, a positive, or one should perhaps call it negative bias, just against maternity in general, that employers find the whole maternity setup and women leaving to have their children a real inconvenience? Now, you know, we know everybody's supposed to be joining in and joyful about all of this, but frankly, a lot of employers just say, you know, it's a real pain in the neck, and I'm not certain I'm enjoying this.
Undoubtedly, there is a cohort of employers, especially among SMEs, that perhaps aren't as don't have as sophisticated HR practices as others. And you know, there is some research which suggests that discrimination is taking place among a small minority of employers in the way you describe. But what I would also say is that ultimately this is a short-term outlook. And what we need to do is look beyond the short term. What we're seeing is higher educational attainment levels from young women entering the jobs market. They're outperforming boys in schools, and as a result, what we will see is more women move into higher paid roles, move into the professions, which is already happening at a great pace. And if employers don't respond to that, then they will simply miss out on talent, which will exacerbate the skill shortages that employers consistently complain about, without perhaps looking sometimes at their own practices, which often cause recruitment problems because of the poor retention levels.
Gerwin Davis of the CIPD. In a moment, life in the gig economy of 18th century London. Stay with us.
Share Radio Weekend, getting to the beating heart of business.
Welcome back. You're on the shop floor. Now, we think of the gig economy, people working a variety of different jobs to make up one salary, expedited by technology, as something new and different, peculiar to this tech-centric world of the 21st century. But as so often in this life, there ain't nothing new under the sun, give or take a smartphone or two. Judy Stevenson is a researcher in economic history at Wadham College, Oxford.
Before about 1800, very few people had what you or I would call a job. They had work on a more casual basis, or they were usually paid for their production rather than their time.
So give us an idea of what that means.
Well, I researched London workers in the 18th century, and people in manufacturing were mostly paid by the piece. So they weren't paid for their time, but they were paid for the number of things they produced. Piecework is everywhere in the early modern world. It is the way that manufacturers or capitalists make protect themselves from risk and manage their costs, and it is the way that workers choose how much and when to work. So it's a flexible system. It's meant to work for both parties, but in the long run, I have to say, business owners did better out of it than workers.
There really ain't nothing new under the sun.
Yes.
What sort of unusual jobs could people do to earn money, and how did they get the work?
Well, how they got the work is something we don't know nearly enough about. There's a lot written about houses of call, which were essentially pubs or meeting areas where people met to be hired for particular work by the day or for particular task work. London in the 18th century has every occupation under the sun. In fact, it's even more multifarious than now. There's all sorts of workers. Those at the bottom of the pile tended to be in moving things around, and we would think of them as labourers or less skilled than labourers, very unskilled workers. Working on the river, working in the construction industry, carrying, carting, working in transport. Remember, this is before there were public transportation systems or even engines to get us around, a lot of people actually carried others through carts and sedans around the city and carried goods as well.
So give us some idea of some of the more unusual things people were doing.
To our mind, the scavenging and the carriage of rubbish and night soil, also known as sewage, would be an unusual work. But there's also some extremely high-end and skilled manufacturing production in London. Many pieces of, let's say, fans or musical instruments or clocks, sort of very fine goods, many pieces of those would be made around the country or in different places, then assembled in London by the sort of final craftsman and signed by him. So, I mean, yeah, it's a very multifarious picture. Is there anything particularly you're interested in finding out more about?
Yeah, there is, actually, because in the Financial Times, I read a story about the carpenters who maintained the timber starlings on London Bridge. What on earth is that all about?
So London Bridge was the only means of crossing the Thames at London until they built Westminster Bridge in the late 1730s. It only opened in 1750. And London Bridge, as you probably know, was built in the 13th century, and it was 19 masonry piers across the river, which naturally became quite warm. So they erected timber, they're like protectors, we call them starlings, and they were shaped around the masonry piers in the river. But obviously the water, the Thames in those days was still very much a tidal river. This is before the sewers and the banks or the embankments were built, so that the starlings needed constant maintenance. And it was the job of the tide carpenters to literally stop London Bridge from falling down. So they used to row out in boats, and when the tide was down, they could carry out the repairs. And when the tide was up, the masons could get to the stone parts of the bridge to carry out repairs as well. So there were large teams working on the bridge. You'd have several carpenters, labourers assisting them. And then at either end of the bridge, they also had water wheels, which were providing water and milling. And they were looked after by the gin men, the engine men. And they seemed to be very unskilled. They were very lowly paid. And they only got paid by the tide. So if the weather and the tides obliged to produce work, or you know, to be able to get out there in daylight hours, you got work. But when the Thames was frozen over or the tides worked, you worked in the wrong way and you couldn't work in daylight, you had fewer tides. So they were very much at the mercy of the seasons in terms of how they were paid and the work availability.
That does seem very insecure. I mean, how did people, you know, sort of keep their budgets, their household budgets, if there was such a thing? It must have been very, very difficult.
It must have been. This is something, again, that economic historians really want to know more about. But you don't find many working class people in the 18th century keeping accounts. Although there are accounts and diaries for the 19th century, we don't have as many for the 18th century. And we think that people ran a lot of book credit. So they sort of had an account with the butcher, the baker, etc., and paid when they had cash. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that housing worked quite differently in this period. People didn't all live in a family unit, in a family, in individual units or homes. They sometimes lived in where they worked, or they had access to sort of subsidised housing. Housing generally was a smaller proportion of budgets in those days. Many literally slept virtually rough. So in the large institutions such as Westminster Abbey, there is a feeling that people who were employed casually may have been, you know, sleeping under the under the arches, or, you know, generally kind of scavenging the sort of some kind of subsistence from the kitchens and places that they worked.
What they did have, and what we are now trying to return to in some force, is a very strong apprenticeship system. And that was how craftsmen, to be fair, that's how they learned their craft and their trade.
Yes, apprenticeship is really important in the transmission of skills in the early modern work, but it's also really important for the transmission of management skills. So I research a lot about masons and carpenters particularly, and you find that not all those who learn a manual skill are apprenticed. Some of them are, you know, just literally shadow somebody until they learn a basic skill. Apprenticeship tends to be for the very, very skilled people or those who will trade on their own account, as in become business owners. But apprenticeship really grows throughout the 18th century, and it becomes increasingly important until the Napoleonic Wars. And it's the key means by which people found out about a trade and got the skills that they needed to both carry it out and manage the business side of it.
It's one of my favorite stories about apprenticeships is the bit they made, the thing they made before they graduated and were given permission to go out into the wide world of commerce by their masters. The bit they made was called the masterpiece.
Was called the masterpiece, yes. Unfortunately, you don't see a lot of those in the 18th century. Masterpieces tend to be from slightly earlier. Apprenticeship in England is longer than you find in many places. It's 7 years in most trades. And most people, particularly in the manual trades, would be able to do something worthy of a masterpiece well before 7 years. So 7 years is really a means of keeping them under the auspices of, with somebody responsible for their development, from the age of 14 to their early 20s. So yes, unfortunately, we don't see many masterpieces in the 18th century.
And keeping them that long was also a way of stopping the competition from nipping at your heels too early, of course.
Absolutely, from taking the skill. I mean, you should also bear in mind that many people who were apprenticed never actually became freemen and, you know, achieved business status. They never actually set up by themselves. Rather, they became jobbing journeymen, so basically craftsmen available to hire for others, and never got either the capital or the enterprise together to have their own business. So apprenticeship trains many, many people, but only an elite from it go on to actually have their own apprentices.
Everything started to change as the Industrial Revolution began to kick in and technology began to take jobs away from people in agriculture. And I suppose that also means that the system of paying people must have changed. We must have gone on to weekly wages, that sort of thing.
Yes. The piece rate survives in a number of trades for quite a long time. In steelmaking and ironworking particularly, the foreman or the contractor would be paid for the amount he produced, but then he'd pay his underhands in either day work or another way, and he'd sort of get the margin in between. But it wasn't until the Second Reform Act and how that came into effect in the late 1860s, 1867 onwards, that labour and organisations and trades unions actually had the power to bargain effectively for proper pay. And the pay that they bargained for was to be paid for the time for their week and a weekly wage. And so from the late 19th century, that becomes the norm. And after the First World War and the Second World War and all the sort of reforms of the 20th century enshrine that. So, you know, all our tax returns, everything we understand today about productivity and the way that work relates to GDP and everything are enshrined in the idea of an hourly rate or average weekly earnings. But that seems to have been a small amount of time, just a century of stuff in the long run history of labour, which before that is all about the piece rate, really. In the long run, in the 18th century, piece workers did have flexibility, and that meant that some of them could carry on several trades, just like the sort of freelancers of today. But the predominant feature of 18th century earnings are that the real wage for working people over the century declined by, depending on which wage and price you use, something like 40%. So it is only when workers, you know, got rights altogether in the 19th century that the, you know, the welfare of labour within the whole system improved. And I don't think anybody wants to go back to a completely regulated market, because the flexibility seems to be something that the Uber workers particularly cherish. But there's got to be some kind of protections. It'll be interesting to see what sort of solutions they come up with, no matter what the ruling is.
Judy Stevenson from Wadham College, Oxford. Fascinating stuff there. Coming up after the break, Lord Baker, who's Kenneth Baker, the former Conservative Education Secretary in the 1980s, gives his 21st century successors a piece of his mind.
Share Radio Weekend. Getting to the beating heart of business.
You're on the shop floor with me, Nick Peters. Now, there have been stories recently that the University Technical College Network, funded by the former Conservative Education Secretary, Kenneth Baker, is not in very good shape. Lord Baker, as he now is, established UTCs a few years ago to provide a secondary education for 14 to 19-year-olds, with a specific aim of preparing them for careers in industry. Now, apparently, there have been closures and falling student rolls, and an article in the Times declared that the whole project was a massive flop. I asked Lord Baker for his reaction to such a damning headline.
It was written by someone who's a disciple of Michael Gove, and Michael Gove disliked technical colleges altogether and can't get over it. In fact, far from flopping, they're thriving. We have 48 open. We've got over nearly 12,000 students at them now. They're placed all over the country, and they are the colleges which are most attuned to business interests in the country, because they're demanding colleges 8:30 to 5 every day, and for 2 days of the week the students are actually designing things with their hands in either metal or computing or something of that sort. It's hands-on learning alongside academic learning. And the thing that we're most proud of is that when we have leavers at 18, virtually nobody joins the ranks of the unemployed. We had this last July, this summer, 1,292 leavers, and only 5 became NEETs. I don't think any other school can do that in the country, quite frankly, or group of schools. Our students go to various things. 44% go to university. Nearly 30% become apprentices. And apprentices and hired apprentices are now the thing. They're catching on very, very strongly indeed. And we have some of our students turning down university places to do it, because they then work for a big company like Rolls-Royce or Network Rail or National Grid, or even medium-sized or smaller companies, where they are earning somewhere between 15 or 20,000 a year. And the company, because they can do that, because by going to a UTC, they've got probably an A-level in maths or physics or chemistry or life sciences, an academic A-level, but also they've got a practical diploma like the BTEC extended diploma, or maybe advanced level engineering, i.e. they're highly employable because they've got both an academic and a practical qualification that means something. And so companies like those, and what often happens is that when they start in the company, whatever it is, Siemens or whatever it is, they're usually put through at the company's cost a degree, a foundation degree. So they get a degree with no debt. So that's proving very, very attractive to youngsters. But they have to have got technical qualifications. Otherwise, if you just have academic qualifications, very few companies would employ you as a hired apprentice.
But you surely would not deny, sir, that that it would be highly preferable to have more people going into UTCs, more young people.
Oh, yes.
And I'm wondering if it's anything to do with the age, the entry age at 14, when the more natural change points for children are surely 11 or 16.
It's highly historic that it's 11. The reason why it's 11, and hardly any other country, advanced country, changes at 11. And it's 11 because the school leaving age at the end of the 19th century was 11, and the only schools that went beyond it were the grammar schools. And so that became the departure point. It's not educationally a good departure point. The natural transfers of children are at 9, because up to 9 in primary you're taught by a single teacher, or 13, 14, which is what the private sector does. And what Europe does, Europe is moving to a transfer at lower secondary at 14, upper secondary at 14. And from upper secondary, it becomes much more technical. We have always done very badly in Britain with technical education. In fact, virtually every attempt since 1870 has failed. And this means that if you look at Austrian or Swiss or German or Netherlands students, by the time they've reached 18, 70 to 80% of them had some experience of technical education. In Britain, it's 30%. And so when we set up the UTCs, we said the right age is 14. It's too early to bring technical work and engineering work at 11 to 11-year-olds. But at 13, 14, they like it, and they do well at it. And it is challenging because it's not a natural age of transfer. And we've asked the department for 3 years, because Gove never liked them, so it didn't really help us, to do two things: to get the local authorities to write to the parents of all the children of 13 in their area, tell them about UTCs, and many of them don't do that because the schools they're responsible for say, no, we don't want them to come in, we lose children to them, and that sort of thing. But now they're going to change the law, and I think the law will be changed by early next year. And we also want the law changed to allow the heads of UTCs to go into the schools to explain to the youngsters of 13 the nature of this, of what a UTC is.
I just wonder, though, whether there is a sort of cultural disconnect between what the economy needs and what the population thinks it wants. I mean, everything you spelled out about the virtues of a technical education, parents should be, you know, knocking your doors down, and they're not.
Yes. Well, the people who are very supportive of us are companies up and down the country. We're supported by over 600 companies, big and small, because the local employers at each UTC are first, the controlling numbers on the board are the local employers and the local university. And we expect the local employers to produce projects for students to work on. For example, Rolls-Royce has lessons of 8 weeks in making piston pumps. Network Rail has lessons of 8 weeks on level crossing gates communications, and they come in, they bring level crossing gates and train sets in, and staff from the companies come and teach. And students love that. And what I find very encouraging is that we deal with lots of small and medium-sized companies in the engineering industry, some of which, you know, I've never heard of, people haven't heard of, but they're flourishing. The companies I see supporting UTCs are working 7 days a week in shifts, and they like them because we can produce more apprentices than any other school in the country. And one of the great advantages of ours is that students actually work in teams. Well, life is working in teams, but you would get no experience of that in an ordinary school. And also, they deal with problem solving. You get no experience of that in an ordinary school. They make things with their hands. They get no experience of that. And there's a total dysfunction now between what the economy needs and what the education system is producing, because the education system is going down a more academic route.
Yes, you've been very critical of the EBAC, which is now part of the curriculum, because it doesn't, it focuses too much on academic subjects. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. The subject that I introduced into the national curriculum in the 1980s was design technology. And for the last 5 years under the coalition government, it declined in numbers by 30 or 40%. And schools below 16 are being virtually told, abandon all those technical subjects and creative subjects, music, art, drama, are all down as well, to concentrate on this range of academic subjects, which incidentally was exactly the curriculum announced in 1904 by Dr. Constant, the secretary to the Board of Education, word for word, except Dr. Constant added one technical subject, drawing. And so there is a dysfunction. I think our schools, when people know about our schools and local parents know about it, they become very enthusiastic about them. And we find that youngsters at 13, 14 can make up their own minds where their interests lie. At 11, they can't. The 11 plus depends upon parental choice, not upon student choice. At 13, 14, we have students and parents making the decision together.
I bet you never thought you'd see the day when a career in industry was regarded as a second-class option.
Yes, it's very, very sad because we have such a huge skill shortage, and the skills gap grew larger under the last government. And the skills gap, just at graduate level for a start, they're 40,000 short of STEM graduates a year each year for the next 4 years. And then it comes down to the foundation degree level. And at that level, there's something like about 500,000 short. And when it comes down to professional technicians at level three, they're about 800,000 short. And this is why we have to have so many people coming in as skilled immigrants. Estonia's biggest export are computer scientists. We are not producing enough computer scientists. I'll give you a precise example. Last July, in GCSEs, 60,000 students took computing science, 60,000. 300,000 took a foreign language. Now, what is more important in a job, to have a mastery of a computer language or a smattering of a foreign language? There's no answer to that. Well, clearly, there is an answer. It's clearly better to have a computer language. When I went to see Charlie Mayfield, who's the chief executive of John Lewis and Waitrose, I wanted to talk about food technology because one of our UTCs wanted to do food technology and we knew absolutely nothing about it. He said, I'm sorry, my biggest problem is I just cannot recruit computer scientists, computer specialists, graduates who can, because I have a logistic business. I would have people who've got to make quite sure that the right goods are in the right store at the right price on the right day, in the right color or the right shape. And this is a huge logistic operation. And it's perfectly true. We're simply not producing enough computer scientists. Nowhere near. And so the whole system has got to be fundamentally changed. And we're the people trying to change it. We've got 8 or 10 wanting to apply next year, and maybe more towards the end of next year. And we're just catching on. Industry likes us. We are, these colleges are employer-led, industry-led colleges. We expect the local employers to actually determine the shape of the curriculum as one of their first jobs.
I think there's an interesting point about the way the education system is structured. There's a financial incentive for schools to recruit children at Key Stage 4. They've taken their GCSEs to recruit them into sixth form because they make cash from that. That's where they get their funding.
Yes, of course.
And logically, that means they're guiding them to university when they may not be suitable. The dropout rates from sixth form are quite horrendous. And of course, these children then become lost to education and training.
And often lost to a job. And you see, the consequences of the digital revolution, which is going to be profound, and I take when I've written a pamphlet on this, that unlike all the other industrial revolutions and technological revolutions, this revolution is going to destroy more jobs than it creates because it affects absolutely every industry in our country and commercial activity in our country and the world. And the agents are so pervasive. Big data, artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, driverless vehicles, driverless cars, robotics generally, and cybersecurity, and the cloud, and the net. It affects everybody. And you've got to be very facile to find a way through, and very, very flexible, rather. The pattern of jobs in the future are going to be much more part-time jobs and self-employment jobs. They are the fastest growing segments of the employment area. And there are various big studies now being published by the editor at the Davos meeting this year in January. There was a report which was absolutely devastating about the effect of technology on jobs. Millions are going to disappear. Other jobs will emerge, but to have them, you have to have a range of skills, not just academic subjects. You have to have worked in team, problem solved, made things with your hands, been flexible. And so I think we're training our youngsters for the jobs of tomorrow.
Well, you are, but the education system isn't. and is what I'm hearing you say.
It's catching on. We've got to improve skills training dramatically. Otherwise, we'll never deal with the immigration problem, put it very bluntly.
Lord Baker customarily pulling no punches. In a moment, why it's vital his mission to get more young people interested in industry succeeds. Stay with us.
Share Radio Weekend, getting to the beating heart of business.
Welcome back.
The advent of the fourth industrial revolution is going to be massive on work, on commerce, on society. It's all about automation, connectedness, as in the Internet of Things, and robotics. We heard Lord Baker talk about that a few minutes ago. Now, while it's a very big deal for companies, few people talk about what it means for the workforce. That's a discussion that's being encouraged by Kronos, the company that provides businesses with workforce management tools. I asked Rob Hiron of Kronos what he thought the impact on employees will be.
As everybody knows, Industry 4.0 focuses on automation and technology, and as such, jobs in production, jobs in manufacturing will continue to move towards being more high-tech, more highly skilled. The workforce, the people that work in organizations on production lines, in factories, in manufacturing facilities, will need to have greater skills, greater knowledge of science, technology, maths, in order to be able to work in this more high-tech environment. So, you know, these skills, these greater levels of mathematical science skills will then drive a higher pay because they're going to be more responsible for high-tech production lines that will have high-tech goods coming off the other end of the production line. So I think it will have a massive impact. Throw into the mix as well that, you know, Industry 4.0 is looking at big data, it's looking at the Internet of Things. Everything is going to be data-driven now. You know, big data is a massive part of Industry 4.0. Then everybody in the manufacturing world will need data, be exposed to greater levels of data. It will be data-driven, and so they'll need to be able to have visibility, react to it, understand it, and react accordingly to drive this high-tech world forward. So I think it's going to have a massive impact, and I think some organizations are really grasping that, and other organizations aren't. And I think that the ones that do will really stretch forward and really grasp it and move forward very, very quickly.
Well, we'll look at that in a second, but you talk about the need for the workers of the future to have these skills. But we've just been hearing from Lord Baker, the founder of the University Technical Colleges, that the UK education system is failing to produce enough trained young people for the 4.0 future, and not enough young people and their parents are wanting to train in technical subjects. I mean, how do businesses get the word out that a career in industry is both fulfilling and highly rewarding and nothing like the sort of production lines of the past?
Yeah, and I think you're right. And it's almost a marketing job, I think, Nick. I think it's almost as we have marketing departments in any organisation, I think schools, even the government to a certain extent, needs to almost create their own marketing to show people how manufacturing is still a fantastic place to work. And I think you're right. I think a lot of people will have the traditional view of manufacturing that it's still dark and dingy factories, it's still people working on production lines, it's not very high tech at all, you know, people go in for a shift and they do this and bells go off when the shift finishes, and it's very, you know, what people have been used to seeing in the old days on TV and in magazines. And I've been around a lot of factories recently. I've been lucky enough to go around, you know, the Jaguar Land Rover factory, the, you know, famous food manufacturers, and it's really high tech and it's really engrossing and it's a really exciting place to work. And I think what the, you know, the technical colleges, where the universities, the schools need to do is really show people that, you know, what we use every day is manufactured somewhere. And those manufacturing environments are very highly skilled, very clean, very high-tech environments that are fantastic places to be. And I think they do it well in certain parts. You know, we've got projects like the Bloodhound project, which is really exciting. I believe it's actually a year today that they do the first run for 800 miles an hour. So 365 days and counting. So, but they visited a lot of the schools. They've come to my kids' schools, and the kids were massively excited when they understood that, you know, what science and what manufacturing skills went into this incredible car that's going to go 800 miles an hour on the first run, hopefully, and then 1,000 miles an hour. They were really excited. And, you know, my 9-year-old son came back home and talked about, well, wow, this is what we're doing, and we're building it in England, and this is how they build it, Daddy. And he was really excited because he'd been exposed to what manufacturing and engineering actually is in the real world. I just think we need to get better at marketing it. I think it's, you know, you talk to many manufacturing organizations and jobs are very highly paid. They're very highly skilled. They're very highly respected. You know, and I think if someone could get a manufacturing job in a Formula One team, then they'd be very attracted to it. And it's really carrying that on and making people visible to what's out there nowadays. And the image has completely changed because the manufacturing world has completely changed. And I think we ought to look to what other people do as well. I mean, you know, I have a lot of colleagues in the US, and Cronus works very closely with manufacturing over there, and it's a massive part of our business. And they have something called the Manufacturing Day, which is a single day in October every year where manufacturers around different regions open their doors up to families and to the future workforce to show them how exciting manufacturing is and what people make, how it's made, to really get the youngsters and the millennials and the people that are going to be the next generation of workers to see that manufacturing is an attractive place to be. And, you know, people can be very successful in the manufacturing environment. And I think that's a great thing to do and something we may think about doing in the UK. I think it would be a fantastic thing to do and really get people to see what we actually do over here and how good we are at manufacturing. We're world-renowned, Nick, for our manufacturing skills. I think sometimes we're very shy about showing those off.
Next week, I'm going to be up in Birmingham at the NEC for the manufacturers' annual conference on manufacturing and also for the Smart Expo, which is going to show off some of this amazing kit that is going to be part of the Industry 4.0 revolution. I sometimes wonder, though, Rob, whether what we tend to do is we tend to get very focused on the technology around this and don't really reflect on how to help people adapt to it. I know that's something that you're very concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked very closely with manufacturers now for, you know, 10 years and I've gone into manufacturers and all I've heard for many, many years is, you know, we're spending money on automation. We're spending money on new kits, new assets, changing the factory. And they seem to concentrate a lot on machinery. And the element that they seem to have forgotten about or now realizing that they need to concentrate on is the people, is the workforce. Because putting it very simply, you can have all the equipment in the world, but you still need the best skilled resource and people to get the most out of those machines. And, you know, it's something that has been neglected, and the forward-thinking organizations has grasped this now and are really concentrating on the workforce because a skilled workforce is required because they may be doing multiple jobs at one time. You know, I went to one of my customers recently, and they have one individual that is skilled up to a high level on seven different elements to run a machine that's worth tens of millions of pounds. And they've realized that, yes, the machine is there, but unless they invest and look after the skilled workforce or the skilled employee that's going to run that machine, they're not going to get the best out of it. So they realize that the balance is, yes, you've got to have high-tech machineries, but you've got to invest the same time, skills, and money in the people to run it to get the most out of them. So it's something I'm really passionate about. I think people are identifying they need to do this more effectively. They need to concentrate on the workforce more effectively because if they don't, they may lose that workforce and so they'll lose that skilled asset and they have to start the whole process again. So it's something that, you know, I am very passionate about. We are very passionate at Cronus because, you know, the employees are great assets and you need to concentrate on utilizing the skills, which will then in turn improve the productivity, produce high quality goods, maintain the customer service, and basically, you know, fulfill a lot of the requirements that makes a successful manufacturing organization.
Cronus is your whole raison d'etre is workforce management and giving employers the tools to do that. We're moving into a brave new world where people may have several jobs. They're demanding incredible degrees of flexibility in a way that people of the old dinosaur generation like myself could only dream of. Now, do you have tools or have you developed tools that will enable employers to actually make that workable for young people who expect this flexibility and, of course, workable for the people who pay their wages?
Absolutely. And I think I'm with you in the dinosaur range as well there, Nick. So I think it's something that, is a massive change. And yeah, Kronos is, you know, our technology specializes in optimizing employee engagement to get the most out of the employees, because we recognize that the world is changing. So, you know, to both attract and retain employees in the manufacturing environment, you need to be able to give them access to their data, access to their manufacturing life, wherever they want access. You know, the mobile, the smartphone, everybody lives on the smartphone nowadays. So what we do, our systems allow the employees to have information and get that information at their fingertips via the smartphone. And that could be simple things that, you know, when am I working next week? It could be, you know, I would like to swap a shift with you, Nick, because I've just seen my favorite artist is going to come in and do a concert. I'm actually booked to do a shift when that concert's on. So what I want to do on my smartphone is request a shift swap with you, so I can go and see my favorite singer. You're happy to swap the shifts, and we've done that all with clicks of our good old thumbs on an iPhone or on an Android phone or whatever it may be. And it's the way that people live nowadays. They live on their phones, so they can do shift swaps. They can look at holidays and request holidays via their mobile phone. They can put their availability in there. So again, if they're managing multiple jobs, they can put their preferred availability. So when people are scheduling them to come into work, they know that Rob isn't available on a Thursday night because he takes his son to rugby practice, for example. So it's all about giving the information at their fingertips for the modern workforce, but also allowing them that flexibility and work-life balance. So because that's what everybody wants nowadays. People want that balance to be correct. They want the flexibility to be able to do things quickly and easily and change things. And employers need to adapt to that, because you will only retain the skilled employees and the productive employees and the skilled employees if you give them that flexibility. So it's both from an employee point of view and an employer's point of view that you need to really give that facility. And that's what Kronos has invested a lot of time, money and effort in, working with our customers and obviously looking at industry and industry trends to really allow them to have the systems to optimize their workforce to get the most out of them every single day, every single week of every single year.
Rob Hiron of Kronos. And that's it from the shop floor. I'm Nick Peters. Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to bring you stories from the world of work for the last 2 years. Goodbye.